Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. This week, we will be looking at new evidence that a major extinction event more than 300 million years ago was caused by the explosion of a nearby star. We will also look at how a quantum version of the board game Go could put artificial intelligence systems to the test. But first up is Deji Akinwande, who is professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. He is an expert on flexible electronics, and in the upcoming clip, he speaks to Physics World's Margaret Harris about the technological challenges of using 2D materials to create futuristic devices. Things like foldable radios you can take to the beach and graphene tattoos that can monitor your blood pressure.
So most people listening to the podcast will have heard of the most famous 2D material, which is graphene, this atomically thick form of carbon that was first isolated around 15 years ago. And I think you started out working on graphene as well, but the focus of your research has shifted since then, moving on to other 2D materials. So if you could tell us about what are these other materials, what their properties are, and sort of what prompted you to investigate them, that would be really helpful.
We are still working on graphene. It's just we have expanded to investigate the other 2D materials as well that you mentioned. And the value of the other 2D materials and the motivation for investigating them is because they have properties that graphene does not have. So they are graphene is unique in its own sense, in its material properties. And those other materials are also unique from an electronic point of view or from an optical point of view or from a magnetic point of view. So they're very worthy of consideration, very similar to, you have a car, you have a sports car that has its own value if you want speed on a fast road. And you also have a truck if you want to carry cargo during transportation. So those 2D materials complement what graphene has to offer in a unique way.
And a few years ago, you used one of those other 2D materials, which is molybdenum disulfide, to make a flexible transistor. What did that project involve?
So that's a very multidisciplinary project, and that was actually a challenging project for us at that time because, I'm an electrical engineer and an applied physicist, but that project also involved quite a bit of material science in terms of material synthesis. So we had to go really from the bottoms up, like starting with growing the materials ourselves, then putting this material on a flexible substrate like plastic, Kapton tape that many of your readers may be familiar with. And then we had to create devices on this non-electronic substrate. And then after fabricating this, we have to characterize that the devices are of good quality and do measurements. So it's kind of very multidisciplinary, spanning material science, materials chemistry, to applied physics, to electronic measurements.
And what were you able to do once you made this flexible transistor? What are some of the applications of, sort of flexible electronic devices?
So the applications, the flexible technology is actually one of the driving applications of these materials. And this flexible technology can be used, for example, let me give you two things that we've worked on, and it's still a matter of very active investigation. Some of them have been translated into applications. One of them is in transparent conductive films, very similar to what is used in mobile phones. These materials are thinner than what is currently used, so they are much more transparent. So that means brighter screen or more battery efficient screens. And they can also be used for radios. So we've demonstrated, for example, flexible radios. So you can have a piece of plastic. You could have a speaker on the piece of plastic, and that piece of plastic can receive signals, let's say music signals, wirelessly, and can play them. So you can think of having a foldable or a flexible radio that you can unfold. Like when you go to the when you go to the beach or something like this. So another application is graphene tattoos, where you put this on the skin and you can record your vital signals, and then you can convey that information to an app on a mobile phone.
For healthcare, for perhaps? So like recording your heartbeat and that sort of thing?
Yeah, for mobile health. So it can record your pulse, your heartbeat, your blood pressure. So we're working, for example, on a blood pressure, monitoring continuous blood pressure, which is very important for many, many diagnostic reasons in medicine.
So you talked about the need to make all the different elements of a radio be flexible. And more recently, you've been working on developing sort of flexible memory. So you developed a device that you called an atom wrister. Can you explain what an atom wrister is?
Yes, so it turns out if you look at the vast array of electronic components, the memory component is the most important today. And that's why you see, for example, when you buy a smartphone, if you get 512 gigabytes or 256 gigabytes of memory, it's going to cost you a significant difference in money. So we realized then that to make a complete flexible system, we needed to have memories for information storage. So one needs to have a memory that is flexible. So memory is, of course, a component that stores information in binary code, like one or zero, and they can represent data, video, images, and so on and so forth. So in order to make the flexible memory, you need materials that themselves flexible. So the 2D materials are actually the best class or category of materials that are naturally flexible, because flexibility means the material must be very thin. So in the pursuit of the ultimate a thin material, one finds that 2D materials are actually the thinnest material that exists in nature. So we call these atom wristers because these are atomically thin. They're less than 1 nanometer thick, and you can make them from molybdenum disulfide, which is a common 2D material, and that can lead to flexible memory. So that was a discovery that we made a few years ago, and we continue to advance this today.
And so your most recent work is kind of an extension of that project. It involves different 2D material, which is hexagonal boron nitride, or HBN for short. And I think you've used that to make a switch that works for signals in the RF, or radio frequency band. Is that right?
Yes. So besides information storage, we were challenged by some of our sponsors to consider whether new applications could be served by these materials, this memory technology. And so we began to explore, for example, hexagonal boron nitride, which is the thinnest insulator on Earth. And we found out that not only is it good as a memory, but as a memory, it could also allow or be used as a switch. So a switch is a component that toggles the different bands of communication, for example, we have on our mobile networks. So for example, for 5G, there are many, 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 many bands. You have LTE, you have 4G, 3G, 2G, you have Bluetooth, and so on and so forth. So a switch needs to be able to toggle this and to do it rapidly without consuming significant energy. So the current switch is a transistor switch that consumes a lot of energy, because it's, even when it's not toggling or switching, just the standby energy to keep it operational is substantial. So by using a memory switch, which is what we have been working on and developing, it's a new application of this, the standby consumption of energy is zero. So your battery life can be extended significantly. It's also much faster, so it can transmit not only 5G, but what is being called 6G. That means 100 gigabits per second data. So for streaming applications, that's unheard of.
Back at the beginning, I mentioned graphene, and some of our listeners will remember that there was a lot of hype about this material when it was first isolated back in the mid-2000s. You know, it had all these astonishing electronic and mechanical properties. It was definitely going to change the world. You've worked with graphene, and you've worked with a lot of different 2D materials and done some amazing things with them. But the devices you're making, they're still in the early stages, I think. They're not really commercial yet.
going from an idea to a product, if you look historically at the evolution of invention, it takes about 20 to 30 years to take an idea from concept to product. So graphene has really been in development in 10 years, 2D materials in general. So it's still really at a, I would say, nascent stage. Nonetheless, there have been several applications, including some of what we have worked on, that are already in the market today. So for example, we worked on transparent graphene materials for transparent conductive films. That became a real technology. Certain smartphones in Asia, you can buy this. They're using the graphene for the transparent conductive film applications, and they've sold a reasonable amount of volume of these phones. You can buy graphene. We work on sensors. So some of our esteemed colleagues have commercialized sensor technology. You can buy this in the market from, let's say, for example, a startup company in San Diego sells graphene, monolayer graphene sensors. And there are many other applications in composites that are used in packaging of smartphones to spread the heat at the back of the phone, for batteries, both in industrial battery technology or mobile battery technology. And then consumer applications like for reinforcing the frames of bicycles so that they're lighter and stronger, for hiking shoes so they're lighter and stronger. So there are a variety of applications actually today that are using graphene materials in products that one can buy.
What do you think the future holds for electronic devices made from 2D materials?
Well, the future, I would say, is brighter than it was a few years ago. And the reason I say that is because several of the leading semiconductor companies like TSMC, Intel, and European companies as well, they're investing a huge amount of infrastructure and talent and R&D funds to try to integrate these materials in a semiconductor technology based on silicon. So based on these trends from these well-known leading companies, I think the future is bright for bringing these materials to electronic devices.
Deji Akinwande, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time speaking to us today.
Margaret, it's a pleasure.
Around 359 million years ago, the Earth suffered a massive extinction event known as the Hengenberg crisis, which is thought to be caused by a huge reduction in Earth's life-preserving ozone layer. Now, an international team of astronomers led by Brian Fields at the University of Illinois has proposed that Earth's ozone was stripped away by a process involving cosmic rays created in a nearby supernova. I'm joined down the line from Philadelphia by Logan Chipkin, who's written an article for Physics World about this idea that an exploding star has had a profound effect on life on Earth. Hi, Logan.
Hamish, thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure, Logan. Now, you've pitched this story to us. Why were you interested in writing about this work by Brian Fields?
Yes, one of my interests in science is broadly the history of the universe and also leading up to the history of life and evolution and increases in complexity and so forth. And I found the research to be almost poetic in that there's no separating the rest of the happenings of the universe out there in space, as it were, from the happenings of life on Earth. So I found that connection really beautiful.
Sort of in a nutshell, what did Fields and colleagues do, and how did that lead them to the conclusion that a supernova may have been implicated in this, I suppose, catastrophe for life on Earth?
Yes. So there was this extinction event about 359 million years ago, as you mentioned, and it's thought that this was in correspondence with a reduction in ozone layer, which would have led to a reduction in species diversity. And there had been previous hypotheses to explain this reduction in ozone layer. For example, sometimes scientists said that maybe there was excess volcanic activity. Others attributed it to different chemical cycles, but Fields and his colleagues don't think that that would be quite enough to explain the extinction event we're talking about, because the extinction event we're talking about seems to have been A, over long periods of time, and B, roughly global. And so something more extreme had to have caused the ozone reduction such that the extinction event from 359 million years ago had occurred. And so they thought, well, what about a supernova explosion?
And when you say over a long period of time, I think in your article you mentioned 300,000 years?
Yes, that's what it seems to be so far. Now, some of these estimates are a little bit rough, but yes, yeah, certainly over a very long period of time. And by the way, order of magnitude in the hundreds of thousands of years, it's also thought that because the ozone sometimes repairs itself over much shorter time spans, and so that's another reason that something continuous had to have been kind of assaulting the Earth in order for the ozone to remain in its deteriorated state.
Okay. And maybe you can just remind our listeners what a supernova is. It's an exploding star, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So a supernova is just a star that has exploded. There are different types of supernovas. For example, you could have a massive star have a core collapse, which basically just means it becomes too massive for itself and then spills its guts out into the universe. And then there are other types. For example, a white dwarf could accrete matter from a binary companion. So we have binary star systems in the universe. And interestingly, the different supernova types, although they have similar explosion energies, they produce different isotopes. And so they would leave different trails of evidence, which is also kind of cool.
Right. And I think you mentioned in your article that, a smoking gun that could give a lot of credence to this idea is finding certain radioactive isotopes in the fossil record associated with that period. Is that right?
People have already found isotope signatures from other supernova explosions. So finding this evidence seems plausible in principle. But yes, if it was found that certain isotopes were found in the fossil record or in the archaeological record from this time period, that would be a, as you said, definitely a smoking gun that a supernova had exploded and spilled its guts and cosmic rays onto Earth during the time period in which this extinction event took place.
And I think the distance to the supernova is critical, isn't it? Because in your article you do mention sort of this kill zone of supernovas. You know, probably not a cheery thought to be thinking of. But if a supernova is too close to us, then that's it for life on Earth. This supernova had to be a specific distance, didn't it, from the Earth in order to have an effect, but not basically wipe out everything.
Yes, that was another very interesting constraint on their hypothesis, namely, as you said, if the supernova is too close, life on Earth is done. And given that we're here, something like that has not happened. However, and at the same time, if the supernova is too far away, then Earth would never feel the effects of it. So it has to be in kind of this sweet spot, farther away from the kill zone that would destroy all life on Earth, but close enough that it would affect Earth. And so the authors of this paper said that's about 2 times the kill radius for a core collapse supernova.
Am I right in thinking that they don't have a specific candidate for this? So we can't look out in a telescope and actually see the remnants of the supernova that did that. Is that right?
I think that's right so far. It's interesting to note that the authors also consider the fact that since stars tend to be born into clusters and therefore tend to cluster around stars that are the same age, it could be that if this extinction event was caused by a supernova explosion, there might be other explosions from similar time periods that have caused even other extinctions than the one we're talking about. And so maybe a sign of evidence that this extinction event was caused by a supernova explosion would be kind of a cluster of other supernova explosions across the relevant time span.
Right, because and that's because this particular extinction event that we're talking about, it wasn't the only extinction event that occurred in sort of in that time period of Earth.
Right. So the one that we're talking about is the Hengenberg event, as you said. But then there was another extinction event called the Kellwasser event. It's kind of even calling an event is a bit misleading because they occur over long time periods.
So that's how a supernova could affect life on Earth. But are there any other sort of astrophysical events that that have affected life in the past?
Yes, I think the dinosaurs know quite well how other astrophysical bodies could affect life on Earth. For example, a massive meteor impact. In principle, something as large as the moon could and has impacted Earth. I'm not sure if the moon hit Earth. I think it hit Earth before life began on Earth, but in principle, that does not have to be the case.
And I suppose another example, maybe not quite as threatening, are solar storms, which, given our reliance on electronics, if we got a whopper of a solar storm, that could have a real effect on society and maybe even sort of civilization itself.
Yes, that's a great point. And it also brings up the fact that what constitutes a dangerous threat from the rest of the universe is really predicated on what people in life are doing in order to propagate themselves.
Well, that's great. Thanks, Logan. You can read Logan's article on the Physics World website. It's called "Did a Supernova Trigger the Late Devonian Extinction?" Thanks for being a guest on the Physics World Weekly podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
Now, Margaret Harris is back to talk about another intriguing article that's new on the website. This one is about a machine that plays a quantum version of the ancient board game Go using entangled photons. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, you're a Go enthusiast, so before we get to the quantum bit, how is a classical game of Go played?
Okay, so I guess first I should say I'm definitely, although I'm an enthusiast of Go, I'm definitely not an expert. I was in my university's Go club about sort of 15 years ago or thereabouts. But I can tell you that the classical Go, as I should guess I should call it now, involves two players. One player placing black stones and one player placing white stones. And you place these stones at the vertices of 19 rows and columns that are drawn on a board. So each player takes it in turn to place one stone. And the aim is to use your stones to gradually enclose a larger area of the board than is enclosed by your opponent. And there's just two rules about where you can place stones. The first rule is that every stone remaining in the board needs to have at least one open point at the vertex above, below, left, or right of it, or else it needs to be part of a connected group of stones that has at least one open point of this type. These points are called liberties, and stones or groups of stones that lose their last liberty are considered captured. They get taken off the board. And this rule also means that you can't place a stone in a suicidal location. In other words, a location where it would immediately be considered captured, unless, this is important, unless by doing so you would yourself capture all the encircling stones, which is definitely possible, and it's definitely a real pain in the backside when your opponent does that to you. So that's the first rule. The second rule states that the stones in the board can never go back to the positions they were in at the end of the previous move. So this is to prevent players from being in a situation where they continually capture the same stones from each other over and over again, which would be really boring. You can get situations that are subtly different from this, and that's called a co-fight, where you sort of jockey for position on a certain area of the board, but you can't absolutely exactly repeat positions. And from these two rules, you get an absolutely dizzyingly large array of possible moves in a game, which is why it took almost 20 years longer for a computer to beat a human at Go than it did for a computer to beat a human at chess.
And this quantum version of the game, which I should say was created by Xianmin Jin of Shanghai Jiao Tong University and colleagues, I think each stone is played in a quantum superposition of white and black. I think those are the two colors that are used. Yep. And it remains in a superposition until a piece is played next to it. So I think that's sort of like a measurement in quantum mechanics. So the stone is a bit like Schrodinger, like a Schrodinger's cat, until a measurement makes it either black or white. Is that how it works? And how would that affect the game?
Actually, Hamish, I think that explanation isn't quite right. I admit I'm still getting my head around this, but I think the difference between classical Go and quantum Go is that whereas in classical Go, each player lays down just one stone on each move, in the quantum version, each player places two stones, and these two stones exist in an entangled pair. And both of these entangled stones remain on the board until a player, which could be you or it could be your opponent, places another stone, which is, of course, in itself part of an entangled pair, at an adjacent vertex. And that's the point, that's the measurement point. And that measurement, so to speak, collapses the entangled pairs, that only one stone in the pair remains in play. So it's not a question of whether the stone is black or white, it's a question of whether the stone is really sort of classically there or not. There is a Schrodinger cat element to it, but it's whether the stone is present or absent, not whether it's black or white.
Ah, okay. But I'm guessing that this would have a big effect on how the game is played. Could you imagine yourself playing Go with this with this sort of change of rules, this quantum change of rules?
It sounds really fun because, of course, once the collapse happens, the stone that remains on the board is now classical. It can't collapse again, and it can just be captured in the normal classical way. But the quantum element certainly changes the game radically, because the key thing is that neither you nor your opponent knows which stone in the entangled pair is going to remain in play. In fact, if the two stones in each pair are maximally entangled, then the outcome of the measurement will be completely random. You've got no idea which stone is going to remain on the board. Otherwise, if it's not maximally entangled, then one stone will have a higher probability of remaining on the board than the other. And I think the way it works is that you know that probability for your own stones, but you don't even know the probability for your opponents. So I'm sold on the idea of playing Quantum Go. I think it sounds really fun. It also seems like it'd be really frustrating because you could be about to make this great encircling move, and then oops, the stone you're making with it turns out not to be real. And one of the stones you're relying on disappear when the entanglement collapses might turn out to be the one that remains in play, and suddenly you're in a world of pain. I can also imagine these sort of entanglement fights or collapse fights developing the same way that co-fights develop in classical Go. But I think actually to really appreciate quantum Go, I would need to be a lot better at classical Go than I am.
Now you mentioned this idea of randomness and also the sort of imperfect information that you have or don't have as a player. And I think it was the goal of Jin and colleagues to introduce these elements into Go, which if it didn't have these elements, would be very deterministic. And I think this makes Go maybe a bit like poker, for example, where you don't know which card you're going to get next, and you also don't know which cards your opponents are holding. But does this sort of change Go fundamentally? I mean, I would have guessed that the deterministic aspect of Go is sort of a key element of how the game is played and strategies that people have developed.
Oh, absolutely. I said if the stone that you think you're making an amazing move with turns out not to actually exist, it could completely bug up your strategy. But I think that the really exciting thing about this research is that these researchers, Jin and their colleagues, didn't just talk about quantum Go. They actually made a machine that lets you play it. So they put these ideas into practice by generating pairs of photons with entangled polarizations. And after some quantum jiggery-pokery with beam splitters and single photon detectors, they were able to generate and store a random series of zeros and ones. And they use this random series to assign collapse probabilities to each half of a pair of virtual stones that were positioned on a virtual Go board. And they were actually, by continuously generating these entangled photons and storing the results, they produced about 100 million collapse probabilities in just an hour, which is way more than enough for a game of Go. In fact, it's enough for 100 million moves played on a board with 10,000 rows and columns. And they claim that by increasing the size of the virtual Go board and tuning the entanglements, they claim it should be possible to match the difficulties of the games you mentioned that that have some randomness to them and some uncertain information, like poker and like Mahjong.
And the thing is, this machine, this quantum Go machine, is designed to put artificial intelligence systems to the test. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens if they do manage to hook the machine up to an AI system.
Yeah, that's interesting to me, this idea of putting creating a game of adjustable difficulty that can sort of test AI systems. Because one of the nice things about classical Go is that you can adjust the difficulty of it by giving the weaker player a bunch of stones already in the board in prescribed locations when the game starts. So, you know, if I tried to play Lee Sedol, the Korean champion who was beaten by Google's AlphaGo in 2016, there could, in principle, be an even match between us if he gave me enough starting stones, probably like several dozen or maybe even 100, because, as I said, I'm really bad at Go and he's very, very good at it. But still, in theory, that could happen. So it sounds like Quantum Go has this adjustable difficulty too, in terms of how much, how well known the probabilities are of collapse, that can give AIs an extra challenge, as well as the size of the board, which I think is a nice touch, really.
Yeah, it's really interesting, this idea of a quantum machine playing another machine. You know, it's sort of like the battle of classical and quantum systems. You can read more about this quantized version of Go on the Physics World website. Just look for the article, Quantum Go Machine Plays Ancient Board Game Using Entangled Photons. And that was written by our regular contributor, Edwin Cartledge. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks, Margaret, for your contributions. And also a big thanks to Deji Akinwande, Logan Chipkin, and our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.